The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
To quote the great Joseph Campbell, he said, "It is by going down into the abyss where we recover the treasures of life. Where you stumble, there lies your treasure." To the ironic twist of the unknown.
I know kung fu.
You either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become a villain.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
This whole thing is insane.
300 years ago, you'd have been burned at the stake.
What do all men of power want? More power.
This is now the United States of Zombieland.
This whole thing is insane.
Man is evil. Capable of nothing but destruction.
Everybody is stuck with the things that they're not proud of.
More power.
Welcome to the desert of the real.
More power.
There can be only one.
Are you a God-fearing man, Senator?
That's such a strange phrase. I've always thought of God as a teacher. As a bringer of light, wisdom, and understanding. You see, I think what you really are afraid of is me.
Happy heresies, and yes, welcome to the desert of the real. Welcome to Aeon Byte. Welcome to the virtual Alexandria that, the original Alexandria, Jung called it that place where East meets West. This is that state of mind where East meets West. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am your Pompidus of Gnosis, that madman across the waters of creation. We are running with those searching for the truth and avoiding those who have found it. We are not the final authority on anything, but hope to be an endless possibility for everything. You are the final authority, have always been, and it's time you understood your power. And as always, perhaps most important, my tagline, I hope you're writing your own gospel and living your own myth. And I am very excited about today's show. We will be ending August and September has been a very Jungian month, both by cosmic orders and design, because these ideas are more important than ever before humanity fully fragments into chaos and Jung's warning about the psyche and warfare completely come true. So with us today, I'm very excited to have Dr. Luke Johnson. Luke, thank you very much for coming to the virtual Alexandria.
It's a pleasure to be here, Miguel. I have to say that your show is one of the most profound resources I've come across on the internet. So this merging of the minds is a big deal for me and perhaps for others. I thought perhaps before we get into the subject of today's conversation, just to give a little background to people, so I don't come across as too pedantic. I know that a lot of people who watch your program, including yourself, are deeply, deeply versed in Jung. I'm kind of a newcomer. I have a PhD, but my dissertation was on Soren Kierkegaard many moons ago. And I created a educational social media environment. And in that process, had my eyes open to wider areas of study. And I became deeply fascinated with the cryptographical elements in film, specifically the works of Stanley Kubrick. That's when I started to share some of my own research about 2 years ago. And I don't think that subject is a stranger to your platform. But I think while I was doing a lot of my writing and research on Kubrick, I kind of felt like, you know, the indexing of all the cryptographical elements is interesting in and of itself, but there's a larger metaphysics going on. And I had seen enough evidence to conclude that it's all running through Jung. And so what I've had to do in a hurry is to teach myself as much Jung as possible. And the way that I do this is by putting together presentations and disseminating them on podcasts and my own YouTube channel and Instagram, et cetera, et cetera. And you can find me on, I have a YouTube and a Instagram and a Twitter. You can find me on this first slide that we'll show. Today, I don't know if it's unorthodox or orthodox. I'm going to be kind of reading a lot of prose that I've put together on Carl Jung's 15th volume in the Collected Works. And we're going to be discussing two particular essays from it, and I'll get into that. And I guess it's kind of dynamic. I was mentioned to Miguel, I practiced this earlier today. It took me about 50 minutes to get through it. I don't just run roughshod over you guys. So if you stop me, ask questions, interject. And yeah, because it's kind of a lot of material. So I, for myself to synthesize it all, I have to kind of write it down. But I appreciate the colorful commentary along the way and people who can, I'm sure both of you can help me understand some things that I may have been a little flippant about.
Sure, sure. Of course. Yeah. Our audience is very well versed. Thanks for the kind words. We are Vince and I and Graham are trying to spread as much light, including through all the algorithm suppression we have to suffer, which has always been a battle, but it is reality. So we're definitely excited. Yeah, and for the audience, Luke is in Virginia. I think he's getting some of, what's the name of the hurricane? Helen?
Which yeah, you know
very what? Very Gnostic. Simon's stormy priestess of the moon.
Right. I found that to be synchronous. I don't watch any news or anything. Of course, I Smart. Get it from social media. But, you know, this kind of appeared out of nowhere. But Helena is going to be a figure that we talk about today. Maybe it'll come up specifically because we're going to be talking a lot about Goethe's Faust. And in mm-hmm. Faust Part 2, Helen of Troy is a big part of that story. So it kind of, when I was like, oh man, this hurricane could potentially disrupting our internet connection. And it's within, the name comes from Faust. Or I don't know if it comes from Faust, but it's featured prominently in Faust.
Yeah, and many scholars have noted, yeah, Faust is based on Simon Magus, a lot of it, the legend and everything. There was a legend of Simon Magus, and it developed into Faust. Goethe wasn't the first one by far. It had been around for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. Awesome. Well, we must say hi. Hey, Vance, how are you doing? Any hurricanes?
I'm okay. No hurricanes. Looking out the window here, it's very nice and sunny and a little warm.
Oh, are you sure? I thought you were in outer space.
The only hurricane is Newsom destroying your state piece by piece.
Oh, don't get me into that. I'm collecting plastic bags now. And
yeah, but they've been banned. They've been banned in Chicago for a long time, I think so. But anyway, yeah, let's not get into that. Awesome. For the audience, I see you piling in. Good to see everybody. I hope everybody's well on this Freya day. And as always, if you have any questions or complaints against Vance and I, please super chat them. Not much on the housekeeping. As always, please support this show. Please help keep the lights of the Pleroma on. Keep in mind that all three Astronoses are now available for replay for one price. If you join the Virtual Alexandria Academy, you will get also these replays. All on the show notes, including the Gnostic Tarot, if you saw that very cool intro. And yes, I do have Luke's YouTube also on the show notes. So check out his channel's excellent presentations on all things Jung. So, and I feel, God, I feel I'm just getting Jung after all these years. It's just, you know, there's knowing him and then suddenly it starts to, like a tattoo, it starts to get under your skin and stick. So I'm still learning. So. Shall we get started, Luke?
I think so. You're reading me loud and clear, I hope. I guess we can.
Yeah. All right. Can you see it?
Yeah. And then you All click right. from beginning. See on the ribbon there.
The problem is now it's taken me completely off my. Okay. Now I can't see even my own screen. Oh, boy. All right. We okay. have a little bit of can... problem. Yeah. Why don't we move over here? Because, yeah, I can't. As soon as I did that, it blanked out all my screens, including my StreamYard. So,
oh, I see.
Yeah, for both screens. So
yeah, and we can't see the other. We can't see.
Yeah,
the
Luke,
other
you screen. Can do a screen share. Maybe it'll work better for you.
How do I do that?
Why don't we? Yeah, probably too late to do that. All right. Why don't we just work off of this?
Yeah, that's fine. They'll get the gist. Yeah,
apologies.
Yeah, they'll get the gist. All right. So this first slide, I included it because I want to illustrate the familiarity that Jung had with so many works of great literature. I'm not sure that's something that's widely understood by the connoisseur of Jung. Perhaps it is. But I think it really comes through in the book that we're going to talk about today. I think it's a great picture. I think it has deep meaning, especially given my interest in Kubrick in 2001, A Space Odyssey. Both of these books, both 2001, A Space Odyssey and what Jung is going to talk about today in The Spirit and Man, Art and Literature, are going to draw inspiration from Homer. And as I mentioned, we're going to be looking at The Spirit in Man, Art and Literature. And the two essays that we're going to look at, this is a collation of essays. The first one, On the Relation of Analytical Psychology to Poetry and Psychology in Literature. On the Relation of Analytical Psychology to Poetic Art was first published in the British Journal of Medical Psychology in August of 1923. The second essay, Psychology and Literature, was first published in Berlin in 1930, but then was expanded and revised in Zurich in 1950. For those interested, as Miguel mentioned earlier, I have already covered Jung's essay on Ulysses from this volume on my YouTube channel. So let's begin with On the Relation of Analytical Psychology to Poetry. Art is uncontroversially a psychological activity. However, the application of psychological analysis is limited in practice. Artistic creation may be subject to psychological study, but what art is in and of itself remains a question for aesthetics alone. The same goes for religion. Psychology can address the emotions and phenomenology of the symbols. However, it cannot exhaustively explain their essential nature, and for this reason, art and religion cannot be considered subspecies of reductionist psychology. Jung's concerns are motivated in part by his awareness that psychology itself could be reduced to mere brain activity if a line is not drawn. Even if art, science, and religion intermingle in the minds of the less advanced, such as children, it does not follow that a reductionist principle underlies all these activities. Jung endeavors in this way to turn back the Freudian psychoanalytical tide encroaching on the art world, which aimed to reduce all art products as explicable in terms of personal neurosis. It may be true that many great artists suffered from neurosis, and that knowledge of personal struggles contextualizes their work. However, it can never account for the product of their genius entirely. Jung writes with the Freudian methodology in his sights, and I quote, "It strips the work of art of its shimmering robes and exposes the nakedness and drabness of Homo sapiens, to which species the poet and artist also belong. The golden gleam of artistic creation, the original object of discussion, is extinguished as we apply to it the same corrosive method which we use in analyzing the fantasies of hysteria," unquote. Imagine the inanity of exhuming Nietzsche's brain for a scan to gain an insight into Zarathustra, or allowing a Freudian to diagnose Plato's allegory of the cave as dealing with the womb. No, these works of arts, if we consider them art, are worlds in and of themselves, beyond the mere psychophysiology of common humanity. The reductionist campaign misses the entire point due to blinding zeal. I'm going to read just a little bit more and we'll have a little discussion here. Jung's analytical psychology approach does not treat art as a disease, but rather something supra-personal. Jung effectively analogizes the relationship between art and artist to that of the dynamic between plant and soil. And I quote, "It is a creative reorganization of those very conditions to which a causalistic psychology must always reduce it. The plant is not a mere product of the soil. It is a living, self-contained process, which in essence has nothing to do with the character of the soil. In the same way, the meaning and the individual quality of a work of art inhere within it and not in its extrinsic determinants. One might also describe it as a living being that uses man only as a nutrient medium, employing his capacities according to its own laws and shaping itself to the fulfillment of its own creative purpose." This is not to say that Jung believes all works germinate in the same way within the artist. One group of artists totally identifies with the creative process, imposing stylistic rules with careful precision at every moment. And then there are artists who work completely through inspiration, where conscious decision takes a backseat to what Jung calls the magic circle of an alien will. That's probably going to be the most continuous I'm going to read, but I wanted to offer that opening salvo.
Yeah, beautiful words, very important words for sure. And yeah, I'm glad Jung was there battling, because of course it's been an ongoing battle, right? The CIA in the 20th century trying to destroy art because it somehow destroyed communism. Like, is it today the material reductionist movement is trying to do what the Freudians were doing, and the fight still continues. And that, I like that picture of you. Is that your birthday party?
Oh, you know, that's, I didn't really think too much about it. I don't have a lot of pictures of myself. No, that's me last summer at the I went and saw the doubleheader of Oppenheimer and Barbie. And truthfully, both of those are very symbolic. I guess what Jung would call, as we'll get into it, visionary works of art. Mm-hmm. I actually had the opportunity at a local film festival to dialogue in a public forum with the Kai Bird? Is that his name? He did the source text for the Oppenheimer movie. And I got to ask him if he picked up on the Jungian elements within Oppenheimer, because he wrote American Prometheus, the thing that Nolan used to make the movie. I don't think I articulated my question well enough for him to understand what I was saying, but at least I got to ask it.
It's weird, but
people say to me all the time, they're like, "Luke, why did you go see Barbie? Why did you like Barbie?" Like, the whole Barbie movie is a very political, schismatic thing. Like, you had, like, if you liked Barbie or don't like Barbie is like dependent on your politics. And I was like, guys, this is like a richly symbolic movie, like politics aside.
Yeah, it's very Gnostic. Again, a lot of Jungian themes. And
Kubrickian.
Definitely true. Definitely true. So, yeah. I like the director, what's the name? Greta Wig. I still like Lady Bird much better, but Barbie was pretty decent.
Yeah.
And my kids really liked it. They thought Ken stole the show, all three of them. So
I think that's the general consensus. I actually believe that. Now, looking at it now, I've kind of updated the file on how I view art through this presentation and really my own inner detective work. It seems like Oppenheimer and Barbie are in a dynamic conversation with one another. Mm-hmm. The maker of the bomb and the movie about the bombshell. It's also kind of an Adam and Eve story. Ken and Barbie are Adam and Eve, and the bomb is kind of like this forbidden fruit of knowledge. Not to mention Oppenheimer tried to poison his tutor with a poison apple. Yeah, so you've got the biblical narrative. It's and the bomb's named Trinity. It's so cinematically rich with symbols. And I just like, is this orchestrated, or is the unconscious, the collective unconscious, coursing through these directors? And as time has gone on, I think it's more of the latter.
I would agree. And it also shows you that these minds that were so on a level of anything, even concluding today's sad state of science and intellect, these guys were smart because they were what helped them. They were so deeply into the occult and mysticism, Taoism, Hinduism, Hermit, and that's really how they expanded their minds. And that got a little bit of love in the movie, how they were part-time mystics too.
I feel like Nolan has a grasp of Jung. I don't know as much about Gerwig. And I mean, this is me speculating. I don't know.
Yeah, no.
But
yeah, yeah, definitely Nolan for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get to the next slide. Let's see.
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah, this is a great slide. I had to do some, I'd had to do a lot of preparation in addition to reading the Jung article or articles for this presentation. So let me just go through what we have on the screen here.
Sure.
In what follows, Jung is going to discuss Schiller's distinction of naive and sentimental poetry and Goethe's Faust pretty extensively. In the center here, we have a statue of the aforementioned literature heavyweights. Schiller's naive and sentimental poetry text is difficult to come by, but I believe the Schiller Institute has made an affordable English translation available. Ironically, we're nearly neighbors. To prepare for this presentation, and that's a whole interesting rabbit hole. To prepare for this presentation, I was able to view Heinz Schirk's 1986 Maria Stuart on YouTube, which was really good. I don't know if you guys have ever seen a Schiller play before. This is the only one I got to watch. It was awesome. I recommend everybody watch it. It's free. I believe it's a German version done in 86 and it has subtitles. It also came to my attention that Jung had written about the distinction between naive and sentimental poetry in volume 6, Psychological Types. Now, Psychological Types came out in 1921, so that what we cover today may be seen as a progression or refinement of those earlier views. I have had the time to skim it, and it appears that Jung does not confine himself to Schiller's writing on naive and sentimental poetry. He also applies his typology theory to Schiller's letter on the aesthetic education of man. I didn't have time to get into it, but I did have time to peruse it. And you see here, this is a great statue of Goethe and Schiller. It's highly symbolic as well. I couldn't break it down for you, but they're holding this crown, this wreath, and the scroll. There's lots of little Easter eggs in here.
Yeah.
And here is a picture from the Maria Stuart play that I saw. It's about, it's a kind of open for interpretation who it's about, but I think the Red Queen, I believe, is Elizabeth the First, which ironically, tracing it back to Barbie, I believe Margot Robbie did this movie recently. I don't know if it's called Mary Stuart, but I think it came out since Barbie or something like that. Uh-huh. So we've got a little bit of a fractal happening.
Yeah.
She's almost unrecognizable. She goes from like Barbie being the quintessential bleach blonde to looking like, you know, the Red Queen from Alice in Wonderland, and not in a flattering way at all.
Yeah, so, she's got talent, no doubt about
that. She does. I've noticed that certain actors seem to carry like this alchemical load around with them, and Margot Robbie seems to be one of them. Mm-hmm. But that's a whole thing. So if we go to slide 3.
Okay.
I had to do a little bit of homework. I didn't have time to go through the naive and sentimental poetry book, but I did consult good old Wikipedia and the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. So they're pretty much saying the same thing. So let's just look at the differences between Schiller's naive and sentimental view. And the reason why we're doing this is that Jung is going to expand upon this throughout the rest of our presentation. So the naive view is characterized, it's poetry of direct description. It has a straight narrative. Schiller thinks that all classical Greek poets wrote this way, with the exception of Euripides. And the unreflective naive artist is connected to nature, is guided by instinct and imitates nature. Products are pure, direct, and done with ease. The naive poets touch us through nature, unlike the sentimental poets, which we'll see in a second. Typically, we think of them as less evolved, easy, at peace, and everything is sort of attained through nature. And there's a finite greatness as the teleology of the naive view of poetry. Now, we contrast this with the sentimental view, which has an element of self-consciousness to it. This is going to be something that plagues modernity, according to Schiller. It's self-reflective poetry, and it's built around the author's reflections and relationships to the material. There's this mediating force. It's lost that direct connection to nature. And with the exception of Shakespeare and Goethe, although we'll see that Jung is going to quibble with this, almost all modern poetry is considered sentimental in Schiller's eyes. And Jung thinks, or Schiller claimed that modern people are separated from nature, therefore the evolved modern poet clings to nature with sweet melancholy. He longs for the relationship that he may have had to it in the past. And the only real way that he can touch us is through his ideas, not nature itself, because of that mediating force. And it's typically characterized by higher development of human potential culture, though we, as I mentioned, still long for that naive view. But the upshot to the sentimental view is that there is kind of, I guess, what Schiller called an infinite greatness that one can reach through it. So I can't go too much deeper into it, but that is the crib notes. That's the Cliff Notes version of what Schiller had to say in his naive and sentimental poetry book, which is not very, it's not circulated well. I think the more authoritative translations, it's going to cost like over $100 to get a copy. Whoa. But someone should do that. Someone should do it. And Miguel, I say all this, you know, who one of a guest that you've had on, and I'm going to name check him again later in this presentation, who's just an absolute baller, who knows so much more than me, is Paul Bishop. That guy, like, I hope, I don't know if Paul's listening right now. Paul has written a book, I believe. Paul seems to have written a book on everything. But,
he has. He really has.
and I think at some point he actually addressed Jung and Schiller and Goethe somewhere. And I wouldn't be surprised if he covers this in either even greater depth than I'm going today.
So, very much. Yeah.
Props to Paul. I would have bought your book and read it, but I didn't have the time. if he wants to do a collaboration one day, hit me up.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go to slide 4 and look at how Jung expands upon the Schillerian view of naive and sentimental poetry. He has a lot to say in this first essay. He thinks the naive view of creation, he calls it extroverted, because it's characterized by the subject's subordination to the demands which the object makes upon him, right? I think there is something kind of more passive. The subject of the art process is speaking to him rather than he is imposing certain ideas upon it. And certain examples of this are Goethe's Faust Part 2. Now, Jung makes a distinction that the differences between Faust 1 and Faust Part 2 are drastic, and we're going to look at those differences in the next slide. So I think he would disagree with Goethe being labeled purely sentimental or naive. Faust is not a homogenous work, according to Jung. But also examples of the naive view are Nietzsche's Thus Spake Zarathustra and Schiller's philosophical writings. Jung claimed that poets can be an introverted or extroverted type, but can make art with either the introverted or extroverted attitude, as seen by literary figures creating great works of both varieties. We have Faust 2 being naive, but Faust 1 being sentimental. We have Schiller's philosophical writings being naive, but Schiller's plays, as we'll see in a moment, being sentimental. The poet's consciousness on the naive view is not identical to the creative process. Rather, there's an alien external inspiration that, in reality, according to Jung, is actually his own self. So we're going to get into it. It's going to be the unconscious, the collective unconscious. The expectation here is that works of this type will transcend both the artist's consciousness and our understanding because of this alien will. Works that have strange form and content, meaningful language, and symbols of the unknown can be found here. These works clearly mean more than they say, and the symbols are discernible despite our inability to completely grasp their meaning. There's something that we can't entirely figure out about them. And because this, the aesthetic reception is such, the undefined symbols are highly stimulating. However, they rarely afford pure aesthetic satisfaction. Now, as far as the sentimental view goes, Jung calls this introverted. the subject's assertion of his conscious intentions and aims against the demands of the object. So we are imposing a blueprint upon the object of what we want to achieve artistically. And Jung, as I've mentioned, gives some examples of this. Schiller's plays, I said Faust 1, but perhaps other of Goethe's poems, which I'm not familiar with, maybe you guys are, and Nietzsche's aphorisms, which I am familiar with. Here, the poet's consciousness is identical to the creative process. He thinks he is free, but still, even though he's imposing this blueprint upon the art object, it's almost like the unconscious finds a back door, and he's still affected by an alien will in the creative process, saying more than he realizes. And this is an indirect proof of this unconscious alien will occurs when the poet voluntarily surrenders the creative activity to a higher imperative, or the psychic disturbances when the creative activity is involuntarily broken off. The struggle is realized at that point. One would expect that art of this kind would not transcend the artist's intentions and be readily understood, but unbeknownst to the poet, his work contains symbolic qualities beyond his comprehension that even his audience will not grasp. Both creator and the audience have their consciousness fixed by the spirit of the time. When consciousness evolves, one can revisit the work to understand the hidden symbols. So I think we should have a little conversation about that. Mm-hmm. Miguel, didn't you just put out a book on occult Elvis? And the reason why I bring that up is that I haven't gone deep into it, but he used the, I remember like in college, I had like Elvis Aloha Live from Hawaii, like on vinyl. And I remember he would come out to Thus Spake Zarathustra.
Yeah.
And I saw it years later on YouTube, and he's wearing the jumpsuit and he's got this big sun symbol on the back. And I was like, what's going on here? Does Elvis even know that he's like potentially tapping into some Mithraic mystery? Like, I don't know. And I wonder about how Elvis would match up on these charts of naive and sentimental. You're kind of the authority on it.
Yeah, no.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it, it's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
But his suits were designed based on, yes, occult figures and occult ideas and mystic ideas. I know there's some rumors Mitch Horowitz had these documents where it's based on these visions of ascended masters, but he couldn't find them. But yeah, certainly enough. I mean, Thus Spake Zarathustra, he was, Elvis was a big Kubrick fanatic.
That's was simple. He?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Was he really?
Yeah, 2001 he liked, but Dr. Strangelove was his favorite all-time movie.
That's so fascinating. So,
yeah, he was plugged into these things.
Yeah, I mean, Elvis seems to be like deeply alchemical himself. And it's like, it's this major question that I'm going to try to address at the end, because I'm trying to apply it to like Kubrick, is like, did they even know who they were, or were they being used by the art? And it's like, you know, like, I don't know much about Elvis, but there, you know, there's all sorts of conspiracy theories surrounding him, and like the weirdness of being born a twin, and like twins pop up a lot in occultism. It's just,
oh, yeah, yeah. My book, it's coming out in April. Yeah, all of this will be addressed. And yeah, he knew, and it was, yeah, one big alchemical cosmic drama. And he knew he was into it, too. He knew all these things.
Did he know he had been, like, written into the script of reality?
Yeah, yeah, he knew that. He knew that.
Oh,
and
wow.
He knew, and in my book, he knew when he was going to die. There's lots of evidence, and his death was really a ritual. I mean, you think, just think about it logically. People go, oh, he died on the toilet. Well, think of it symbolically. He died on the throne. Yeah. The last book he was reading before he died was
The Face of God.
You know, yeah. A scientific view of the face of Jesus. So, you know what I mean? And all through the day, he was planning this ritual to leave the world. So, but anyway. That's in the book. That's in the book. Thank you.
Well,
I
look forward to that when you unveil it. I look forward to that.
Yeah, and even as we'll get into the slides, your ideas of what the Senex and the Child Mercury archetype that's in the psyche, Elvis was playing with those too.
So. Wow. Cool. Yeah, I don't know if there was anything else you guys wanted me to talk about here in this chart. I think I tried to make it as clear as possible. And if it's not already obvious, these are my words, but I'm heavily paraphrasing Jung to kind of catch the flavor of his writing.
Sense. Vince, what do you think so far?
Well, I can see very definitely that Jung's viewpoint and the sentimental view really posits a greater consciousness or force beyond the individual. And even though in those days, I don't think they had a big concept of systems theory, I was thinking earlier that, well, it would be like trying to explain this podcast in terms of all the different computers and circuits and so forth, and the electrons running through the gates and in the computer. And there's no way on that level that you could really see or understand the kinds of things that are going on in the system itself, because the system itself is consists of all the individuals like Luke, you and me, and all the computers and all the people out that are watching this. That's a system, an egregore almost. So there you go. So that the naive view is the materialistic view. That's the way it impresses me. And the sentimental view is the view that it's beyond an individual. It's like a system, systemic view. And I think that's what Jung was really feeling, if not directly describing.
Vance, I think what you have to say here is very valuable. I would push back a little bit. I think you're right. And also perhaps I need to clarify a few things. The naive view, I don't think Jung believes that to be materialistic at all. What I think he is trying to communicate about the naive view is that something beyond the individual, from the depths of the collective unconscious, is taking over the individual artist and manifesting the symbols of the collective unconscious, really kind of in an effort to, we'll get to this, to redirect the destiny of mankind. But that's not to say what you're saying about the systems that are involved in the sentimental view, although we haven't really gotten into the granularity of it, that these artists that are creating according to their own sort of blueprint. And when I say blueprint, when talking about it could be just like the structure, like what they're trying to do is to achieve a certain sort of narrative arc to tidy things up, to make things happen in like concrete and discrete acts and movements and things like that. It may just be like a simple template that they're following, or there might be a greater abstract aesthetic theory that they're trying to impose upon it. I don't know if it's like Aristotelian or something like that, that they're trying to do in to make what they think to be great art. But I don't want to say here that Jung is necessarily saying that one form of artistic creation is better than another. Although I think his proclivity is to say that the naive view of art it has something special to it because it's the collective unconscious breaking through the individual. They just kind of accomplish different means. And I think maybe the way I've laid it out here is a little bit misleading by saying here's naive on one side and sentimental on the other side, and they never overlap. But clearly when talking about the sentimental view, that even despite the best efforts of the sentimental mode of creation, the collective unconscious can still find its way in. Even the sentimental artist is not even aware of it. And he says, you know, decades, centuries later, when you have more evolved conscious individuals, they may come back to the work of art and find it replete with symbols that were missed by the original audience. So there is that sort of, there does seem to be a dynamic interplay of the collective unconscious and the ego consciousness that are being mixed together in sentimental art, but the artists themselves don't even recognize what's going on. The naive artists may not even understand that they're being used by the collective unconscious. They might just be along for the ride.
I see. I didn't really catch that subtle thing. I was enticed by the naive view is that, well, it was directly descriptive, you know, the Greeks, you know, doing directly descriptive. So I kind of keyed on that.
It does sound less evolved, doesn't it? It does sound primitive, but that doesn't necessarily mean lesser. It just
Well, a point of view of the author of the naive material, not being aware of what they're doing. Maybe something's being channeled through them,
right,
unbeknownst to them.
Right.
I see. Yeah. So in either case, I guess Jung was saying that the underpinnings of us, the greater reality, is coming through in both sides. Is that what you would say? And it's just that in the sentimental view, it's like the individual's putting more of themselves in it consciously.
Yes, exactly. Okay. I think the collective unconscious is more freely flowing through the naive form of creation. And the sentimental artist may be trying to suppress it to a certain degree. And that might lead to struggle, like writer's block, or like, why can't I finish this? Or like, why is it not working out like the way I want to? It seems like I'm at odds with myself. So that the sentimental artist may be squashing or attempting to squash the collective unconscious, but it'll find a way in.
Okay.
That's my understanding. I'm not the authority. I just, you know, I didn't even know this book existed 4 months ago. So, you know, I'm just a little ahead of other people that I wasn't able to find. I don't think anyone had really done anything on this on the internet. So I find it interesting. This might be the first time this has ever been discussed in any meaningful way on the internet. So, cool. So if we can go to the, why don't we go to the next slide?
All right.
I thought this was important just so we because Faust is so much of the discussion, and you know, I included here, we can take a look at the memes I have here on the right side. I got this meme. There's a Instagram account, Carl Jung memes. I got this from.
Oh wow.
Evil Carl Jung be like, I am probably not related to Goethe. And I'm sure everybody knows this, but like Jung liked to repeat what may be legend, what may be true. I don't know, that he was the illegitimate great grandson of Goethe. Right. And so I think that's part of the reason why he's so obsessed with Faust. And I don't know if you guys have seen this. I saw the most amazing rendition of Faust. The bottom right hand corner, this is still from the YouTube video. It's, I don't know if I can say this, Jan Schwachmeier's Faust from 1994. Have you guys seen this?
No.
It's on YouTube. Free. It's on YouTube. It's free. It's so amazing. It's kind of a very disorienting mixture of like Faust 1 and 2 down to like 90 minutes. But it involves stop motion animation, claymation, puppetry, avant-garde theater. It was like a joint work between like Britain and the Czech Republic and America. And it was, I don't know if you don't know Faust at all, I don't know if I would recommend this being the place to start, or maybe it should be the place you start. It was so bonkers. And I guess this guy has done other things like Alice in Wonderland that I want to check out now, but it was really avant-garde, really amazing. Cool. It's free.
Awesome.
And it's dubbed, because it was a joint collaboration with English countries, English speaking countries, it got dubbed into English. So, and dubbed well. It's not bad dubbing. So, I just thought it would probably be good to review the differences between Faust 1 and Faust 2. And I've switched the categories here. Sentimental now is on the left, but naive is on the right. But Faust 1, you know, Faust 1 is kind of straightforward. It may not be as structured as Faust 2, but it occurs in a much smaller world. It's straightforward. It was first published in 1808, and it basically is, you know, just about Faust's bargain with Mephistopheles. And, you know, there's kind of like a nice little, this is what we're going to accomplish, here's the structure, this is what we're going to do. And then as we see, you know, the second part of Faust, I didn't even realize this until I got deep into it. It didn't come out until 24 years later, 1 year after Goethe passed away. He said, don't publish us until I die. and he had it like locked in a drawer, and they published it 1 year after he passed. And though it adheres to more conventional organization, the topics that it addresses occur in the much wider world of the macrocosmos, and there's so much allegory and classical mythology in it that it can't help but be transmuted into some sort of allegorical or alchemical work of art. And it covers things like psychology, philosophy, politics, mysticism, and history. And so I can't speak to all of this symbology in it, but it's there. And I think that's why Jung is going to call this a naive work of art, is that Goethe, as he progressed in age, created more room. He wasn't as concerned about having a neat, tidy psychological product and say, this is what happens when you make a deal with the devil and here's how you outsmart him. And, you know, like he allowed something to work through him by opening up the cosmos of Faust and Faust II. So I think that's what's happening there. Hmm. Now, if we go to slide six, this is just, you know, I thought this was super interesting. I don't know if many people know this. I'm a student of the space age. I'm deeply interested in the Apollo program. And I don't know if people know this, but they name all the landing sites for each moon landing. I think most people know that the Eagle landed in the Sea of Tranquility, which is very interesting alchemically. But on Apollo 17, the landing sites were all named after works of great fiction. And one of them was, as one of the places that they toured was Faust Crater. And I just thought that was interesting because in the space program, we kind of had to do a Faustian bargain if if anyone's familiar with the character of Wanda von Braun.
Yeah.
I won't spiral too. I don't know.
Yeah, now we're really going into some spicy places, if you will.
Yeah. I know not to go.
Don't even get Kubrick involved, or we'll just go spiral into conspiracy.
Oh, I wouldn't do that. Totally unrelated in slide seven. I did not know this, but Schiller's Ode to Joy is actually part of the fourth movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, which we see in Clockwork Orange that's played for little Alex. And I think, so this adds an interesting interpretive layer. Something I thought, this is just a note that I'm going to pin and maybe someone else will come back to one day, is that my suspicion is that Kubrick may be inviting us to consider Schiller's theories on crime, punishment, and aesthetics when it comes to the fate of little Alex. Schiller wrote a lot about crime and punishment. I'm not someone to ask about it, but I think it's something, it may be a little hint, or maybe it's something that's delivered up by the collective unconscious, say, hey, look at this. So I think that's, so returning to Jung and this, you know, I love these maps of the psyche that are kind of floating out there. Some of them seem to be more authoritative than others. They very much help orient me. Thinking of the creative process as something planted within the human psyche, which draws nourishment from the individual and yet has its own teleology, prompts Jung to identify it as an autonomous complex. This scion of the psyche exists outside the hierarchy of consciousness and may cause disturbances to conscious activities or redirect the ego for its purposes. And I thought this was helpful. I really had to teach myself what Jung thought autonomous complexes were. And so I put together another little table here on nine, and maybe you guys have a better understanding of it, but Jung says this about it.
The pure eternus.
Yeah.
I have many theories of Elvis, but he certainly was the expression of it. And of course, Senex, Kronos, time, Saturn was Colonel Parker. And they were both very extreme, you know, Elvis being Mercury, just having fun, and the Colonel being this force of power. And when you united them, well, they conquered the world. So it was the perfect balance of these two. But
that's I have to get up to speed. I don't. Was Colonel Parker with Elvis before his military days? Or
yeah. But Elvis had made it. Yeah, he made it big with Sun Records, but Colonel Parker took him to like global once. You know, historical sensation. You know,
where did they even get the name Sun Records? Because that predated.
Very good. Yeah. Why was he born in Memphis?
Yeah. Oh my God.
He wasn't born in Memphis. He lived in Memphis.
Right.
So yeah, yeah. When you start looking at Elvis, it just makes so much sense. You go, oh, this is it's so transparent.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, Miguel. It's like whatever you're looking at, it all you've trained your fixation on Elvis. I mean, I was putting together some thoughts on the atomic bomb and Young and Adler the other night, and it's just it's all there. It's almost always there. Or you know, like look at these
well, the universe is always talking. Our soul is always talking to our ego 24/7. It's saying, I got all the answers. Oh, I'll project them onto reality. Oh my God, he's not listening. I'm gonna make him depressed. Listen now.
Almost like a fractal reality where all these patterns keep repeating, you know, down, and up, and, you know.
That's, Vance, I agree with you. I'm very grateful to be on your guys' show today. I had a deep awakening experience about 8 years ago, and that required, kind of getting deep into the Bible. And the more I got into the Bible, the more I kind of picked up on the Gnostic and simulation theory aspects of it. And, you know, it's, I've come to the place, like you talk about, like, I cannot resist the idea that it's simulated in some way, that it's fractal in some way. Mm-hmm. So I know a lot of Christian people give me a lot of grief about that, but I can't deny what I'm seeing, you know? So had to get over it. So I figure if I'm pursuing the truth, God will be merciful to me. let's see here. So yeah, I had to teach myself about autonomous complexes. And, you know, Jung says in this essay that it's a subliminal psychic formation until charged, and it rises above the consciousness threshold. And the creative complex is going to be an autonomous complex. And once perceived, assimilation does not necessarily follow. An autonomous complex is not subject to conscious control, thus it cannot be suppressed or reproduced at will. It arrives and vanishes via its own proclivities. The autonomous complexes frequently underlie pathological processes, so it should be no surprise that the inspired artist in some cases resembles the mentally disturbed. This is not to say autonomous complexes are morbid in and of themselves, for every instinct essentially has such a quality. Only when they are disturbing is it a sign of mental illness. Autonomous complexes emerge from an unconscious aspect of the psyche and strengthened by activating surrounding areas of association. The autonomous complex feeds on energy from consciousness, gradually eroding conscious interests, such as one's ethics, fostering either apathy or degeneration into something infantile. Jung believes this is why so many artists exhibit passivity and immaturity. And, you know, I have a lot of questions. I've not worked my way through all 20 volumes of the collected works of Jung. I have a lot of questions. I generally understand what Jung is trying to say here about autonomous complexes. I can even see from charts like this or maps like this how the complexes are connected to certain archetypal figures as a nuclei. But there's still, like, you know, mechanisms and just in the granularity of it that I want to find out. But I don't know, maybe people in your audience today don't know what an autonomous complex. Perhaps they were like me a month ago.
Yeah. Well, I love reading this because he wrote so much and I get different insights. But yeah, I tell people, just keep going on the complexes, because even Freud agreed that Jung said this is the central theme of my work, and Freud definitely agreed with it because it's such a slam dunk. And when people want to know what a complex is, I think Jung called it a splinter psyche, that takes over us. The shadow is a complex. It can come over, take over us, and we project it, but there's different complexes that Take over our ego. Some say the ego is the complex, but it's the ruling complex that's supposed to deal with reality. So when you let a superiority complex or something like that take over. There's so structures. Much about complexes.
Hmm? Right. It's all structures, subsystems within the system.
I believe exactly. So.
Yeah.
I didn't ask you guys, had you read these essays or read volume 15 before? I didn't even know if you guys have background
here. No.
Okay. Well, that means I'm doing something right if I'm bringing this to people's attention. That's good. There were there are other great essays in that. There's I initially thought maybe I would do something on Paracelsus. There are a couple essays on Paracelsus there. Ulysses, I've done something on. There was some essays on Freud, Richard Wilhelm, and the Golden Flower. Mm. And as an essay on Picasso. There's an essay on Picasso in there too. So I just, little odds and ends that Jung did that were great.
Yeah, yeah. He wrote a lot.
I don't know how he did it. I write a lot and I can't even get one book out. I just keep tearing it up being like, no, this is, I don't have to worry about trying to have a book pay the bills or something like that, or lose a tenure job or anything like that. I feel like I'm continuing to rewrite something until I can solve this personal mystery. I want to know why the pattern keeps showing up. You know, like we talked about, like what's, I guess we're all sort of interested in what's the code of the simulation.
And that's it.
Is it a dream and who's dreaming it?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So in the next slide, I wanted again, so Jung closes this essay by retraining his attention on the symbols within great art. I'm on slide 10. And what do they tell us? He takes this opportunity to reconnect his audience to archetypal theory. The symbols arise from these primordial mythological images within the collective unconscious. Jung sounds very Kantian here, claiming that these are a priori ideas or regulative principles discernible only from their manifestation within art. For another day, I think it would be fascinating to examine how these archetypes descend down inherited lines if they are not manifestly connected to certain regions of the brain, meaning not inborn. Here are two resources I found preparing this slide, and one is from someone who I have quite enjoyed, and I mentioned him earlier, Paul Bishop. He talks about this. He wrote a book. This cover looks a bit dated, so I imagine he wrote this a while ago. Synchronicity and Intellectual Intuition in Kant, Swedenborg, and Jung. Of course, he's got Jung's Beetle on the top here, if you've read his works on synchronicity. And this seemed like a promising article by Valentin Balinovsky, whether Jung was a Kantian. Have you guys done much work on Jung and Kant?
No.
I'm like seeing my past philosophy life potentially merging here. And I'm very tempted to chase, as you can tell by these presentations, I'm very tempted to chase rabbits.
I see. That's where the idealism comes in with Kant.
I think so. Probably elsewhere, but I think when it comes down to getting at the nature of these archetypes, because it's like, he says there are these potentialities that are associated with brain structures. I'm like, yeah, can I get some more info on that? Like, how does that work? So, anyhow, I'm not suspicious. I just like crave to know. So. Yeah. Where are we now? Let's see. I think we're
slide 11 now.
Slide 11. Yeah. So I'd like to share some quotes from Jung here. I'm just going to read one. And really, why I wanted to do this is just, I really wanted to capture his force as a writer. Maybe other people do, but I don't think Jung is appreciated enough. He's very powerful. And he writes, just to kind of cap this off, whoever speaks in primordial images speaks with 1,000 voices. He enthralls and overpowers, while at the same time he lifts the idea he is seeking to express out of the occasional and the transitory into the realm of the ever-enduring. He transmutes our personal destiny into the destiny of mankind and evokes in us all those beneficent forces that ever and anon have enabled humanity to find a refuge from every peril and to outlive the longest night.
Beautiful.
And yeah, it is so beautiful. There's more, but I see we're at the hour mark, so I'm going to try to rein it in a little here. But what's so fascinating about this is that the creative process seems to act through individuals in order to change the fate of nations and redirect the timeline. So like, how crazy is that to think yeah. that the music, you know, Van, you know, in a past life, I made music and I guess Vance is still making music. And, you know, to think that whether we know it or not, something is coming through us and trying to guide us back to the middle way, whether you are Beethoven or an unknown person like myself, like we are in some way contributing to that. And I think a lot of people think they're doing like activism or something like that with their art, but it's really the people who are not doing that. I think those artists would kind of be considered more of the sentimental artists. It's yeah. those of us who are just letting it flow through us who are actually, you know, are actually the ones kind of, I don't want to say this because it sounds like a savior complex, but saving the world in some way by kind of guiding it back to where it needs to be.
Agreed. So agreed.
I thought that, and you know, I don't know, Vance, the type of music that you made, if you ever had those moments where it felt like something was coming through you.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Especially if I wrote songs.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, it's intriguing. It's like you kind of mastered the technique enough so that when it starts to come through you, you can just serve it, you know, and oh, not yeah. get in the way of it, you know.
Then you have to ask, how did we get to the point where the world needed savings? What kind of forces were pushing yeah, well, us
did I
there?
Ask you?
So we got a yeah. dualistic sense of what's running everybody. At the subterranean, you know, archetypical levels.
Right. Right. You know, and I have a lot of work to do on this. I think my research is going to take me deep into Jung's thoughts on Gnosticism and mythology. And
hey, shining crazy diamonds, please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten, and the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.